A legal education means you will learn to speak in a new language. You will be taught to achieve insight into the world around you and to sharply question what you know.
You can't handle the truth!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Joan Weisblatt from Comedians at Law and Only in Law School, and this is our podcast. Tonight, I'm going to be taking over responsibilities from Matt Ritter, and this podcast will be conducted by myself and Ndidi Origi, another member of Comedians at Law and Only in Law School. Hello, Ndidi.
Hi, Joan. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. I've enjoyed this like fantastic weather we're having in New York today.
Oh, I know. I know. And believe it or not, it's exactly the same in New Jersey. Probably a little smoggier here, but it is. It's a beautiful day and just wonderful to be outside.
Yeah, it makes everything better when the sun is shining.
It sure does. So why don't we get started, Ndidi? We have some stories to talk about today with our listeners. And the first one that I would like to address is the Oscar Pistorius story. Now, have you been following this trial at all?
Yeah, you know, when it first happened, I was definitely kind of paying attention to it, and it was all over the place, and it's a pretty crazy story. It's one of those that's truth is stranger than fiction.
Oh, absolutely. And what I find so fascinating about it is the divergence between what Well, not that this is probably what happens in every criminal trial, but the divergence between what the prosecutor says and what Oscar Pistorius says. And just to give our listeners some background, although I'm sure that most of them know about it, this is a murder trial taking place before a judge only in South Africa. Oscar Pistorius is an Olympian who is an amputee and a runner who was accused of murdering his girlfriend by shooting her through the bathroom door. And his defense is that he came to realize that his girlfriend was not in the bed. He thought that he was shooting at an intruder.
Yeah, I mean, I you know, from when I first heard the story until today, it's very difficult to sort of get into it because obviously none of us were there. But it seems very strange that he would, you know, shoot through a bathroom door when the one other person who was in the room with him is not there, and, you know, not sort of verifying, you know, who was there. But it's, you know, stranger things have happened. We never know because we're not there. I find it interesting that the judge in the case actually ordered a mental evaluation for him, which is one of the things we were talking about earlier, Joan.
Right.
That, you know, it's sort of like at this point, there's no question of his guilt because, you know, he shot the gun. It was his bullet from his gun that killed his girlfriend.
Right.
And now it's just a matter of, you know, how do you balance any sort of issues that he might have had with the fact that he, you know, clearly did this. There's no question at all about who did it. It's definitely
right.
Him.
And it's his story and he's sticking to it. It's not as though he's setting up for an insanity defense.
Yeah, what fascinated me was, you know, my husband is actually a criminal defense lawyer, and I asked him about whether in our criminal justice system, a judge can just order a mental health evaluation. And, you know, he said theoretically they could if the person who the defendant was exhibiting behaviors or in other ways acting as though they might have some sort of issue.
Yes.
And so the judge can, you know, independently just say, hey, we want a mental evaluation. Because when I was reading about the case in South Africa, I thought it was interesting that it was the judge who ordered it rather than, you know, his defense attorney
right,
saying,
right,
hey, our client has these issues.
Right, exactly. I also find it fascinating that this case is tried before a judge rather than a jury of his peers. It's so foreign to us. Normally in a criminal trial, we would expect there to be a jury of 12. And here it's just one person who's going to make a decision about his guilt or innocence. And it, to me, that's a little bit scary.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you're saying that. You just actually reminded me. I just was on a jury a few weeks ago.
Really?
I had jury duty, and I normally don't get picked because they don't like picking lawyers, but
right,
for some reason they missed it at this one, and they picked me, and it was a trust in estates case. It wasn't anything criminal, at all. But I kept thinking to myself, thank God it's not a criminal trial, because I don't know how I would, you know, deliberate in this way and sort of come to a decision if someone's freedom was at stake. You know, yes. It's one thing. Obviously, that case was important to the people in it. And even though it was a trust in the state's case, you know, all of us, there were six jurors because it was a civil case. And we approached it with the seriousness that it demanded.
Sure.
But it's very different talking about, you know, some sort of inheritance and who should get what than it is to talk about someone's life and whether or not they should, you know, spend the rest of their life or a significant chunk of their life in prison.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I also find it very interesting that in this particular case, the prosecutor has been berating Oscar Pistorius throughout the trial in a way that if there were a jury, the judge would never permit that behavior on the part right. of the prosecutor. But he's judge and jury, so, you know, he's giving the prosecutor an awful lot of latitude.
Right. You know, it's interesting because I also felt like in the case that I was on that the judge was she was always very, very careful. She asked there were actually three sets of lawyers because there was the person who was actually contesting the will. And then there were two other interested parties. And the judge had the lawyers on a very tight leash. You know, she would not let them sort of go from, you know, talking about the facts of the case into the law. And she would say, hey, I'm the one who's supposed to be giving the jurors direction on the law. So don't, you know, shoot, you know, watch yourself, counselor.
Right,
it was almost
exactly.
like being on a TV show. You know, she was very, she kept it very clear. It was very church and state. You talk about the facts, jurors decide on the facts, and I instruct them on the law. And they're not here to decide the law. And so that is interesting that there, because it's just in front of a judge, you know, the prosecutor can talk just however he wants because it's only one person.
Right. And he's been trash talking the entire trial. I mean, I find it so fascinating because, you know, he's gotten away with so much more than any prosecutor could ever get away with in the United States. But, you know, we'll have to see what happens with this. And, but he's been, just one more thing about this is that, and you wouldn't see this here, is that the trial has been adjourned for a month. And
yeah.
he is in patient psychiatric evaluation for a month. Can you imagine that happening in the United States?
Yeah, I cannot. They need to get that done in 24 hours and you know, wrap it up. Yeah,
yeah,
for a month, just kind of in the middle of a criminal trial.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind a psychiatric hospitalization for a month just to, you know, take a little vacation from life.
Right, right.
So it gives him some time, too, to kind of figure out what his next move is going to be.
Right.
So, tell us the story about Martin Tankleff. I think this is fascinating too. He's the gentleman who was imprisoned for I don't know how many years, over
yeah,
20 years.
I found that so interesting. So this is one of the stories we wanted to share with our listeners is that, you know, this man Martin Tankleff, he's a 42-year-old man, a New York man who was convicted of killing his parents in 1990. And he eventually got out of jail in 2007 after an appeals court overturned the conviction because of some new evidence. And there were some new witnesses that came up and sort of identified the real killer. And so he, you know, was released from prison, you know, 17 years later. And he actually sued the city and he got $3.4 million in a settlement, which personally, I would not think that that was enough for spending, you know, 17 years in jail.
Right.
And then he actually also graduated from law school this year, which is amazing to me. He got a degree from Thoreau Law Center and
Yes.
And he is going to become executive director of a group that works to free wrongfully convicted inmates, which is kind of amazing.
It's almost like a calling. Here's somebody who's experienced this. And, you know, you would think that after all of these years, he would come out so bitter that he wouldn't want to have anything to do with the justice system. And here he's taking the bull by the horns and trying to make changes, which I think is great. You know?
Yeah, I love that. And to me, it's always really fascinating when you hear about people who are wrongfully convicted. They spend, you know, 10 years, 15 years, 20, 25, 30 years in jail. And they're never bitter when they come out. And you know what that says to me? That says to me that prison is really, really horrible.
Absolutely.
To think that you could spend all the time in there, and when you get out, even though you're wrongfully convicted, you're just so happy to be out that you don't even feel bitter. Because I always imagine I would be very, very bitter for the rest of my life.
I get bitter when somebody snubs me, let alone puts me in jail for 17 years.
I get bitter having to wait in line too long at the bank, you know, so.
Oh, you too?
Imagine spending all that
time. I guess it doesn't take much to tee us off, right?
No, it doesn't. But it just makes me think, man, jail is just the worst, because for people to come out and just be like, thank goodness I'm free, you know, I'm going to do something with my life, and I'm not going to sort of try to, you know, spend the rest of my life seeking retribution. It's amazing to me, and congratulations to him.
I know. I feel the same way that you do about it. Our final story tonight is about a gentleman who realized that something was going quite wrong with his credit, and he couldn't figure out what it was until it became obvious that his own father had stolen his identity and was using his social security number and all of his personal information in order to make purchases for himself. Can you imagine your parent ever doing something like this? I mean, I don't know about you and Dee Dee, but I can't imagine my parents doing this.
Yeah, this is terrible. Well, first of all, my parents are immigrants, so they would have to do a lot of work to even figure out how to steal someone's identity. But, you know, the funniest part of this is that, you know, the gentleman's name was, you know, in the news. His name was Dwayne Keith Long, and his father had the same exact name. So he was a junior, and his father was a senior, and that was what his father used to steal his identity. But I was wondering why he was suing his father for $1 million in damages when his father had racked up $90,000. I doubt he can pay even $1, or he wouldn't have to have stolen his identity.
Yeah.
That sounded just awful. And I mean, what can the guy do? He has the same exact name as his father. I would change my name if I were him.
I was just about to say that too. I would change my name to anything as long as it wouldn't be the same name as my dad.
Yeah, maybe he can be DeKeith Wayne Long and switch it around so that his father couldn't steal his identity anymore. But it's pretty sad, though, that you have to not only watch out for internet thieves, you know, and people trying to swipe your credit card and take all your information online, you also have to now watch out for your own family member.
Right. You have to watch out for people who you invite to a barbecue. You know, who you let babysit for your children.
Right. They might end up stealing your identity.
Stranger things have happened. So, Ndidi, how about giving a shout out to our Twitter listeners?
Yeah.
Listeners. I don't mean listeners. Our Twitter followers.
Our followers. Yeah. We have some wonderful followers. We're past, you know, 1,500. And I think that's really great. And we love it when you guys tweet us, when you follow us, all of that. And I want to give a shout out to a couple of our followers, Duncar N, which is my favorite name with dashes in it. Rebecca Angel is another one. Shout out to Rebecca. And Christina Marie L. Thanks for following us. And we are looking forward to everything that you guys have to say. So please tweet us about any of the stuff that we talked about today, any topics that you think we should talk about in future podcasts, and especially if you want us to perform for you, we are available, and we're happy to respond to you by tweet, Facebook, anywhere. Just get in touch with us.
Absolutely. And also, I'd like to give a shout out to all of those law students who've graduated from law school who are now studying for the bar. Good luck to everybody. I wish you all well. I would never want to do that again in my life, but we all have to go through it if we're lawyers. So good luck to all of you.
Good luck. And all of those on Only in Law School, I want to give you guys a shout out too. Follow us at either Only in Law School or at Comedians at Law.
Wonderful. And Dee Dee, it was great to talk to you. And goodbye, listeners, and hope to have you back soon. Take care.
Bye, Joan.
Bye-bye.
You're out of order. You're out of order. The whole trial is out of order.
What are you doing, detective? What are you doing talking to my client without me present? You sneaky Pete.
Lose. I don't lose. I win! I'm a lawyer! That's my job! That's what I do! Just stay till they're rockin', rockin', just downtown as well.